Hi, I'm Sarah Gardner, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of November 23rd, 2012. Thanksgiving has come and gone, but some of us are still eating leftovers.
I often find that leftovers are a little bit of an issue for us because there's only about five of us usually at the dinner, and my mom usually makes about 13 dishes and six desserts.
Plus, why are so many home loans falling apart at the last minute?
The scrutinization is maybe a little bit overboard, but I sure wouldn't want to see them go back to what it was.
And how about those folks who still stand in line for Black Friday deals?
I feel like someone should let these people know that there's a thing now called the internet, and if you use it, you can stay home and just click on stuff. It'll come right to your house.
Well, the joke's on you, Jimmy Kimmel.
We believe that 6% of all internet sales will be done from an iPad or a similar tablet. And that's something that we didn't see at all last year.
Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from APM.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
Guys, I am so happy to be at work today. I spent the last couple days in the kitchen, either cooking or cleaning up or racking my brains trying to find some awesome leftover turkey recipe. And the turkey tacos weren't such a hit, let me tell you. So it's time to move on from the excess of Thanksgiving and tackle much more serious subjects here on Marketplace Money, like holiday shopping. Well, admit it, some of you are in the car right now on your way to the mall. And this year, retailers were trying to get you into the stores before you even Tupperware'd that leftover turkey. Black Friday has officially become, well, Black Thursday evening. Stores like Walmart and Toys R Us actually open their doors at 8 p.m. on Thanksgiving. Richard Feinberg teaches consumer science and retailing at Purdue University. He's what you might call a holiday shopping scholar. Professor Feinberg, welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, I've been told there are a lot of myths surrounding the holiday shopping season. So you set me straight on some of these, okay? And we'll start with number one, that holiday shoppers really want to get out there Thanksgiving evening. They want to shop earlier and more often, and that's why the big box stores are offering shopping right after we're done with turkey dinner and football.
Well, they certainly want to shop. We will be collecting the data, and we'll let you know whether or not Thursday night turns out to be a terrific idea. You know, I have never underestimated the attractiveness of a good sale to draw people out of their stupor and into the stores. They will go into the store at 12 at night, at 4 in the morning, at 6 in the afternoon.
Now, in fact, you have talked about shopping as sort of a primal need, right?
Oh, absolutely. It is a hunting and gathering sport. It is as if they got up and went out and shot the biggest animal they could and came back and shared it with the family. The stories of great conquests are sort of family history and family lore.
Yeah.
And when I'm out there and I'm talking to consumers, they're there with their sons and their daughters and their sisters and brothers and their family members, and it's a social fun event.
Now, okay, here's assumption number two. Black Friday is the busiest shopping day of the year. Is that true?
No, it has not been the busiest shopping day of the year for many years. That day occurs on the Saturday before Christmas.
Yeah, which suggests that a lot of people procrastinate and they're not necessarily, you know, out there looking for those big deals that supposedly are on Black Friday, right? There's a lot of procrastinators among us.
50% of all shopping occurs in the last 2 weeks, but they're procrastinating because they believe that they will get even better deals if they wait to the last minute.
Yeah, and that's true, isn't it?
It depends on how much inventory the retailers have to sell. If they have a lot left over, they're going to want to get rid of it. And if they can't get rid of it on Black Friday and the 2 weeks into the holiday season, they're going to try to get rid of it the weekend before Christmas.
And it's sort of like a game of chicken between the retailers and the buyers, right? You know, the buyers sort of try to hold off as long as they can, thinking that retailers will come down on price, and then retailers sort of have to decide when they're going to lower their prices.
That's a great analogy. I'm going to steal that one from you, a game of chicken. It is indeed a game of chicken.
Okay, assumption number three. You can get the best deals on Black Friday with those doorbuster deals that we all hear about.
Yes, you can. And if you're willing to pitch your tent and get there hours before, you can get the 50 flat-screen TVs for $50. The thing that intrigues me when I go out there is that even though consumers might know that only up to the 50th person gets the great deal, I like to talk to the person who's number 100, and I ask them, why are they still there? Yeah. And they have this incredible belief and this hope that the retailer is going to come through, or that the people in front of them really don't want it, or maybe the retailer has miscounted and they have 100 flat-screen TVs.
Right.
It really is quite remarkable.
Yeah. Why else would people stand hours and hours in line with strangers?
We're all part of the same tribe. We tribal behavior. It is quite social. It is quite fun. There's a lot of sharing, a lot of joking. The myth is that people don't like it. In fact, the fact is that people do like it.
Here's my last one. Cyber Monday, which is the Monday after Thanksgiving, is a huge online sales day for the holiday season, and it's really important to retailers.
Well, let's start with it's really important to retailers. The answer to that question is yes. But Cyber Monday has decreased in peakness. 2010, there was a Cyber Monday where there was a very substantial, very significant uptick in internet shopping. A lot of that had to do with the fact that internet shopping was still relatively new to 75% of the American population.
Right.
And they had to wait to get to work to get access to broadband, which is the real key to shopping on the internet. Now, we all know that we don't have to do it that Monday, that we can, that shipping is free, and that shipping will get the merchandise to us quickly. And so there's just no more large uptick on Cyber Monday anymore, so I would call that a myth.
What about the folks that use their smartphones to shop when they're actually in a store?
It's called showrooming, where consumers are using these big box stores as showrooms. And while they're there, even as they're talking, I saw somebody as they're talking to a salesperson get on their smartphone and check the price on Amazon. I thought, wait till you get out of the store. I mean, be a little courteous. But, the consumer is in control. The fact of the matter is that the consumer is in charge. And whatever the consumer wants to do, the consumer is going to do.
Does it ever amaze you, given the ease of online shopping these days, that people still go out to, big box stores? I mean, I can't stand the crowds. And it's so easy just to sit at home in your pajamas and shop.
Well, I think the biggest thing that's surprising me is that we believe that 6% of all internet sales will be done from an iPad or a similar tablet. And that's something that we didn't see at all last year.
Wow.
And we think that this trend is just going to be geometrically increasing over the next couple of years. But for 78 million, that's the number of people that we expect to be in the stores this first weekend. For 78 million consumers, they like the sporting event.
Richard Feinberg is a professor of consumer science and retailing at Purdue University. Professor Feinberg, thanks a lot and happy bargain hunting.
Well, thanks, Sarah. I'll see you out there in the mall.
Okay, I mentioned turkey tacos, my feeble attempt at spicing up Thanksgiving leftovers. Well, how about you? Where did your Thanksgiving leftovers end up? It's sad to say, but for many Americans, all that sweet potato pudding and green bean casserole probably ended up in the trash. Of course, maybe you thought the green bean casserole belonged there in the first place, but that's another story. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at the economics of wasted food, especially at this time of year.
What better place to talk to folks about food than a grocery store? Elizabeth Wilson is coming out of a bustling supermarket in downtown Washington, her arms full of groceries. Wilson planned to spend the holiday at her parents' house with their groaning Thanksgiving table and lots of leftovers.
I often find that leftovers are a little bit of an issue for us because there's only about five of us usually at the dinner, and my mom usually makes about 13 dishes and six desserts.
Wilson says she hates to waste, but with that much food, it's inevitable. She estimates that 5 to 10% of the family feast goes in the garbage, but compared to the rest of us, they're doing pretty well. The Natural Resources Defense Council estimates that we Americans trash 40% of our entire food supply. For a family of four, that works out to more than $2,000 a year. Dana Gunders is a food project scientist at NRDC. She puts the numbers in perspective.
Imagine going to the grocery store, buying three bags of groceries, dropping one in the parking lot, and not bothering to pick it up. That's essentially what we're doing in our food system today.
Gunders is talking about all the food we waste, from veggies left to rot in the field because they're not exactly the right shape, to uneaten food on restaurant plates, and of course forgotten leftovers that morph into something monstrous in the refrigerator. Gunders says we waste even more food than usual during Thanksgiving, trashing more than $280 million worth of turkey. She says the pilgrims would be appalled.
It's a time we're celebrating what a struggle it was for those pilgrims to have enough food to survive. And yet the way that we celebrate is by having so much food that we're not able to finish it.
So what are your options if you don't want to waste all that food? Our downtown D.C. grocery shopper, Elizabeth Wilson, says her family has a pretty straightforward strategy for avoiding waste.
Oh, no, just try and eat as much as we possibly humanly can.
But Wilson says her mother does give away a lot of food. She loads everybody up with leftovers before they leave. That's a good way to avoid waste. Talking turkey, you can freeze the parts of your bird you don't eat. Your favorite chicken recipe can be made with turkey. But you have to get creative with the other leftovers jockeying for space in your fridge. Jonathan Bloom is an author and blogger on food waste.
A great way to eliminate fridge food waste is to keep a picture in the back of the fridge. And if you can't see that picture, that means that chances are you have too much food in your fridge.
Bloom says you can be a bit less vigilant when evaluating the contents of your kitchen cabinets. If you didn't use all the boxes of stuffing mix crowding your shelf, think twice about throwing them out, even if they're past their use-by dates. Bloom says those dates just tell you when the product is at its freshest. It's not spoiled after that.
And I think there is this misconception that if we eat a food at 1 minute past the stroke of midnight on the date that is stamped on the package, we're really taking a chance, and that's just not the case.
But Bloom says the best food-saving strategy starts in the grocery store.
10:69.
During holidays and the rest of the year, plan what you're going to get ahead of time. And don't overbuy, because even if you're getting a great deal by buying in bulk, you'll lose money if you end up throwing out mountains of food. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
So how are your leftovers holding up? Have you pushed them as far as they'll go? Or are you whipping up entirely new creations from Aunt Gertrude's green bean casserole? If you still have food left over, upload a photo to Instagram and tag it with @MarketplaceAPM, #leftovers.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now it's time for your letters. Here with me to dispense some financial wisdom is Jill Schlesinger, editor-at-large for CBS Money Watch. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Hey, we're going to talk to our listeners here in a minute. We got a pack of letters in the mail. But first, how was your Thanksgiving, and what are you doing with those turkey leftovers?
My Thanksgiving was fantastic.
Good.
I mean, beyond fantastic. But here's the thing. I'm not one of those people who feels like I have to make my leftovers into something else. But because I wake up so early for work, usually between 4 and 5 o'clock every morning, I can really use this as just having a meal literally at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. I don't care if it's turkey. I'm just going to keep eating it. I need fuel. So that's what I'm doing.
Turkey and stuffing in the morning.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It does not matter.
Okay. Jill, let's go to our first caller, Matthew in San Juan, Puerto Rico. Hey, Matthew.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey, we've got listeners in Puerto Rico. That's fantastic. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we don't have a station here, but I listen to the podcast.
Great. Tell us what you do for a living in San Juan.
Well, I'm in law enforcement, which is a high-risk job to begin with, but San Juan is a very high-crime area, so there's that added element.
All right. What's your question for Jill?
Well, I was married about a year and a half ago and was transferred out here to Puerto Rico, where I will have to work for about 5 years. And while I'm out here, it's just my wife and I. We don't have any kids, and we aren't planning on having any kids. But what I want to know is, do I need to have a will?
This is a great question. The thing that's confusing about this is that you think Puerto Rico, it's a territory. It's just like the U.S., same rules. Not exactly. So let me ask a quick question, Matthew. You are a U.S. citizen, correct?
Correct.
And your wife is as well?
Yes.
Well, as I understand it, if you're a U.S. citizen and a resident alien and you're a bona fide resident of Puerto Rico, you're only required to file a U.S. federal tax return unless if you have income outside of Puerto Rico. And you're basically subject to all the United States estate tax rules. So that's you. You're a guy, you're born in the U.S., you're living down there. So if something happened to you, we have federal law that takes over. Now, that said, under federal law, what would happen is your assets would pass to your wife normally. But that doesn't get you off the hook. I want you to write a will because there are certain quirks to this, which it might go partially to your wife, but partially back up to your parents or to a close relative. So what I think you should be doing, especially because you are in law enforcement and in danger, you want to draft a will. You want to draft a power of attorney. So if something were to happen to you, your wife could make a business decision, a financial decision on your behalf. And you really want to draft a healthcare proxy. If something happens to you, you want to assign her the right to make a healthcare decision on your behalf. Those three documents are your most important guideposts to get through the estate tax rules.
Let me ask you, Matthew, how old are you?
I'm 34.
34. And how dangerous is the job that you have?
As a law enforcement officer, I go out and have to arrest people that have committed crimes. In addition, there were over 1,200 murders in the Commonwealth last year. That rate's gone down a little bit, but it's still a pretty dangerous place to be as far as violent crime goes.
And if I can just pop in here, I mean, look, this is a situation that I would actually say bears so much responsibility on both of you to really move forward and to say exactly what you want to happen. I would say this even if you weren't in a risky kind of business, things happen. What I would suggest, though, is I would suggest that you seek out an attorney to help you out with this because there could be some local rules specific to Puerto Rico that you should be caring about. I really like hiring attorneys to do wills. I don't think you should download it online. Each state has specific rules. See someone who is specializing in estate law in your state, or in your case in Puerto Rico, who can really guide you through this process. It's really important. What you don't want to do is leave your heir or your heirs a mess to tangle with without a will.
Jill, I'm just curious, any downside to people writing a will when they're younger, or is it just good to get it out of the way when you're in your 20s or 30s?
I think it is great practice to actually have a will and to tell the world how you want your assets disposed. You want to tell people where things go. Maybe you've got your mom's silver and you want that to go to your daughter, but whatever it is, just put it down.
Right. Matthew, does that help you?
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for calling and stay safe, okay?
Thanks.
All right, let's go to our next caller. It's Jessica in Exeter, Rhode Island. Jessica, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And what do you do in Exeter?
I actually work in Newport, Rhode Island. I work in domestic violence prevention.
All right. Tell us why you're calling today.
So my partner and I have been dating for 4 years, and we're talking about getting married. My question is around, do we marry each other's debt because we both have some debt that we're trying to get out from underneath? And secondly, how separate can you keep your finances once you are married? Because right now we have things really separate, and
right,
that's working for us. And so we're just trying to figure out what makes the most sense moving forward.
Jill, what do you think? What do you need to know here from Jessica?
Okay, so here's the deal. First of all, kudos to you for actually thinking about this. I think a lot of people walk into their marriages and their relationships and they don't really sort of think through, well, what does this mean financially? So that's number one gold star for you, Jessica. Now, second thing is, you don't actually marry into somebody's debt. You don't. That's not what happens. And in fact, you can keep your credit scores separate. Remember, every credit score is actually based on your Social Security number. When do you start to combine these two credit scores or get the bad effects of somebody else's credit? When you apply for credit together. So when does that usually happen? It would usually happen if you said, okay, we're done renting, we want to buy something. And you then start, you say, okay, I want to buy a house, I have to get a mortgage, and both of you need to be listed in order to get the mortgage. Then you are starting to marry your credit together. Same goes for a credit card. If you actually have a joint credit card, you're now marrying your credit scores, or a car. That's why when you talk to credit experts, what they'll tell you is, as much as possible, keep it separate. Don't marry your credit unless you need to. And in your case, it's totally fine to get married. You will have your debt. He will have his debt. It's a question for you guys as a couple to discuss whether you actually want to be on the hook for one another's debt. Maybe you make a lot of money. Probably not if you're advocating for domestic violence. But that's a conversation to have. But just because if you were making tons of money and you say, I just want to help out my spouse and I'm going to help pay down that debt, it doesn't put you on the hook for that debt. Only on the hook when you co-sign for something.
So can I ask a quick question? I own a house. So I mean, we live in it together, but I bought the house and it's entirely in my name. The mortgage is in my name. Does that stay the same?
Absolutely. And not to be very anti-romantic, but I've heard that sometimes weddings don't turn out the way they plan. So keep the house in your name. That is your house. That is your mortgage. If, you know, a lot of people will get married and they'll say, oh, I'm just going to sign over the title of the house to my spouse. Okay. There's actually no reason to do that. And it almost would be preferable, especially in a state like Rhode Island, where what you bring into the marriage will be yours. You do not live in a community property state. You live in a state where what you bring in is yours. And if something bad happens, the marriage doesn't work out, you walk away with what you brought in. So it's okay to keep that nice and clean.
Okay.
So what I would like to wish you is fantastic success in your future relationship. And I also want you to have a cup of clam chowder at the Black Pearl for me, because it is probably the very best clam chowder in the United States.
Thank you so much. And I will do that sometime very soon.
Very good.
Okay, Jessica, let us know what you decide and if wedding bells are in the near future, okay?
All right. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to our next caller, Peter in Eckerd, New York. Hi, Peter. What's up?
Well, my wife and I, we live in a house now that we own, and we are in the next couple of years going to be building a new home to move to nearby. And we're very early in the process, but I had a very simple question, which has been a little bit baffling, which is how to find out the financial solvency of a building contract. I've heard a couple of stories of people we know and people we don't know of building contractors going belly up in the middle of construction. Part of that is due to, I think, the financial crisis of the last few years. But it just brings up the question, how does one know that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've never built a home.
Oh, that's a great one. So actually, my sister-in-law is a contractor. And so I have always asked her about this. Like, how do you know good from bad? I have you. You're in my family. It's easier. And, you know, she's always said to me, you can always start with the Better Business Bureau. But she says, you really can't stop there. Besides asking for references, you want to make sure that you ask as many people as you possibly can if there are any issues with people they've dealt with in the past. And you can always start to look at some consumer advocacy groups. And, you know, once you get a list of different contractors, you want to get their license numbers and certificates of insurance. I would never do business with someone who doesn't carry insurance. You know, pretty much everyone has to carry it, but sometimes they'll kind of shuck and jive a little bit with you. And you can also use that business license to contact your local municipality and say, hey, is this guy really on the up and up? Once you get to that place, though, it's tough, okay? Because you don't really know if this guy's got 16 projects going on at once or you're the only one. But I would ask, I'd say, how many projects are you going to have going on? Am I number one? My number two? Make sure you get everything in writing. Don't pay for anything up front. Always ask for copies of receipts, those kinds of things. it's a pretty risky business here, but I feel like if you ask enough people, you'll get the information that you need. It's really important to do that.
Yeah, we're very, very thorough on this stuff. And there's also something that I heard of recently called contractorcheck.com.
Yeah, the only reason I didn't want to tell you to do it is that there are a lot of builders who aren't on it, who are good
right.
guys. And so
right.
I don't want to ding someone for not being on that list, you know. And also I think that if you really talk to people who have gone through the process, they're going to tell you about the normal stuff, which is, well, you know, sometimes it's hard to get in touch with them. Sometimes it's easy to get in touch with them. Who knows? You know, it depends on what's going on in your area. So is there a lot of building going on in your community right now?
Yeah, there's a fair amount, I think. There's a fair amount of building, and there's also a lot for sale.
And that probably augurs well for being able to knock out a good deal and being really clear up front. You know, I think that a lot of people run into problems because in the boom times especially, they felt a little bit weird, like, oh, my God, I'm just so lucky he's showing up today. Isn't that fabulous, you know? And so you want to be clear. You don't want to kind of be a nag, but you can say, it sounds like you're super organized, and say, this is what my expectations are, and like a total fine if you can't fulfill my expectations. If this sounds like a pain in the neck project, or you think I'm going to be a pain in the neck client, then no problem. Let's move on.
Great. Pete, thanks so much, and good luck with the home building.
Thanks to you guys. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Okay, our last caller today is Sybil in Sherman Oaks, California. She has a question about getting a health savings account, otherwise known as an HSA. Hi, Sybil.
Hi there.
Welcome to Marketplace Money. So what can we help you out with today?
Well, I had questions on HSAs. I've been a longtime listener, and I love the show. But most people call in about HSAs, they're somebody who their business offers one or they already have one. I'm actually looking at getting one, and my health insurance, my company, doesn't offer one. They only offer an FSA.
First, tell us a little bit about your situation. Why are you looking at a health savings account and flex spending accounts? We'll get to the explanation in a minute, but why are you looking at it?
I was diagnosed with thyroid cancer about 4 months ago. So I know that every year I'm essentially going to be having a lot more expenses
right.
because I have medications now and I have to do a lot of testing for the next 5 to 6 years.
Yeah. First, very sorry about your cancer diagnosis. That's very tough. We'll turn to Jill for the expert explanation. HSAs, FSAs, just a little primer here first, Jill.
Okay, so a flex spending account, which, you know, a lot of people use, is offered through your employer, right? Okay, so here's the deal. What happens is, if you've got a flexible spending account available to you, what your employer is basically doing is setting up a way for you to push money into an account that's used for various expenses. So these flexible spending accounts, it's a little bit more like unreimbursed expenses. Maybe it's a type of provider. Maybe chiropractic isn't covered fully, or if it's for co-pays. It's a little bit harder to get the over-the-counter drugs covered, but you can do it. But it's deductibles, co-pays, co-insurance, any healthcare costs that your current health insurance does not cover. Now, what the deal is right now is with an FSA, starting in next year, you have a cap of $2,500 that can be put aside into that flexible spending, okay? Do you think you're going to spend more than $2,500 in this constant care and updating and all that?
It's very possible, yes.
Really? So that would be in addition to everything that's covered. So $2,500 out of pocket?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes, because I have a very high deductible plan anyways.
Oh, okay.
So I'm a little concerned that it is an issue. Also, I've had a flex spend in the past, and the reason why I've never utilized it again is because, in general, I'm mostly healthy, and so I just kept losing that money.
So, okay, you just brought up a great fact about the flexible spending. They are use it or lose it plans, which is why opticians love December. They always have these people running in saying, I need a pair of glasses. I haven't used my flex spending. So now let's compare this for a second with an HSA, a health savings account, which same thing, tax advantage, right? So money goes in pre-tax, and the funds that go in, they're not subject to federal income tax. Unused amounts, though, can be carried forward. And that's a huge difference. What the deal is that an HSA, you have to be in a high deductible health insurance plan that meets this IRS definition. It sounds like you may be, by the way, because based on what you're saying. And you know what? I think that what you really have to do is you have to, you know, obviously talk to somebody who can help you out with this, which, you know, by the way, it's basically a bank account that's owned by you, regardless of where you work. And what I might do, just because of your situation specifically, is do you work with a CPA?
I do.
I would talk to a CPA. And here's why. I think that there's going to be an interesting situation for you. I don't want to make you like tell me how much money you make, but the bar for deducting medical insurance and unreimbursed costs and just general expenses on our tax returns could be limited based on whether the fiscal cliff happens, based on how much money you have. I would talk to your CPA and I would say, should I just stick with the FSA? It's $2,500. I know I'm going to use that this year. Or do you really think it's worth it for me to establish the health savings account? Because look, in 2013, individuals can actually put more money into the health savings account. It's, I think, $3,100, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
Maybe it might be $3,200. So that'll give you a little extra. And I like the idea that, as you said, you're going to be needing care in the future, that you could carry it forward. But I also don't want you to have to go through the rigmarole of doing it if really the flex spending is the easiest and best solution for your current situation. And best of luck. And, you know, I it's such a rotten thing to get a diagnosis like that, but you're being so smart about how to actually push this forward and say, I don't want to have my – I at least don't want to get, you know, soaked on the financial part of this.
Well, thank you very much for helping clear that up a little bit. It really was something that has been weighing on my mind and what, you know, what the difference is between the two.
Okay. Sybil, best of luck to you and let us know what you decide.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You have a great night.
Okay. You too.
Bye.
And thanks to Jill Schlesinger of CBS Money Watch for all the good advice. Jill, it's been great to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me. I hope to come back at every holiday so that we can talk about our leftovers.
Our favorite
thanks,
topic.
Goodness.
All right. Thanks.
Take care.
Here's something to give thanks for in this ho-hum economy. Sales of existing homes were up last month, more than 2%, in fact, and more than expected. Realtors tell us housing prices are down, credit's cheap. It's all good, right? Well, then why are a lot of home sales falling apart at the last minute? The so-called fallout rate for signed mortgage contracts is the highest it's been in more than 2 years. Now, if you've tried to get a home loan recently, I know what you're thinking. It's the bank's fault. They're nitpicking home loans to death before they give the green light. But as Oregon Public Broadcasting's David Nogueras tells us, there are other factors at play as well.
The last time Dick Eisman bought a house, he told himself he would never move again. But just a few days ago, he and his wife made an offer on this three-bedroom Craftsman bungalow. That after the realtor showed him pictures of the wild elk that roam the forest that runs up against the backyard.
One of the things that we talked about is storage.
Now, here he is in the garage of a house he doesn't even own yet, trying to figure out where to store the Christmas decorations.
And I think now looking at it, yeah, this would be perfect for that.
Just a few months ago, Eisman was doing the same imaginary moving exercise in a completely different house. But the deal fell apart when the couple that was going to buy the Eisman's house backed out.
And when they backed out, we could not complete the contract with the house that we had offered. You know, it was kind of like dominoes. As soon as one fell out, then everything fell out.
Economist Paul Diggle says broken housing contracts aren't new. They're just happening more frequently. Diggle studies the U.S. housing market for the research firm Capital Economics. He says it used to be that about 1 in 20 pending sales would fall through before closing, usually after the home inspection turned up something unexpected, like lead paint or termites. Diggle says right now, the fallout rate is much higher, closer to 1 in 5. For one thing, he says, lenders are still skittish. Remember how the whole global banking system teetered on the brink of systemic failure? But buyers, he says they're ready to go.
So they're signing contracts, but when it comes to the last stage, they're finding that they aren't being approved for that mortgage.
You know, the scrutinization is maybe a little bit overboard, but I sure wouldn't want to see them go back to what it was.
Sandy Garner runs a real estate company here in Bend. Bend saw one of the hottest markets while the housing bubble was inflating and heard one of the loudest pops when it burst. The average price of a home here dropped more than 50%. Now buyers are finally coming back, says Garner, to a very different market, one that moves much, much slower.
We might write for a 45-day close, try to keep the banks moving, but in reality, it may take a little bit longer than that.
For some of our clients, that's about as appealing as a 45-day trip to the dentist. Some people just walk away and start all over again. Garner says that's especially true in short sales, where closing can drag on for months on end. But it's not just tighter lending standards slowing down the process. Brian Lieben is a senior loan officer with Directors Mortgage, also in Bend. As an independent mortgage broker, Liebman makes loans to homeowners much like banks do. He says after the bubble burst, the entire mortgage industry had to downsize. Liebman estimates only 10% of the independent brokers who used to do business here are still open.
If you think of 90% attrition and now mortgage applications increasing, there's a lot less of us to handle that kind of load. The people that are left are busier than they've ever been. Things just have to slow down.
Still, home sales are up, which suggests many buyers whose deals fell through didn't give up. Back at that charming Craftsman bungalow, Dick Eisman admits he was disappointed when he lost out on that first house. But now he thinks it was for the best.
The other house was very nice and would have done just fine. But this one just sings, just feels like it's the very right thing.
Of course, Eisman still has a few weeks before his closing date. And there's always a chance he could change his mind. In Bend, Oregon, I'm David Nogueras for Marketplace.
Between the presidential election, the yo-yoing stock market, and what seems like near daily economic reports, have you had enough of the pundits, prognosticators, and their assorted economic indicators? Well, commentator Scott Hewler says he's glad to get a break from those kind of numbers. Well, he was, until a recent trip to the supermarket.
If nothing else, the Thanksgiving holiday weekend provides a much-needed break. The election is over, and business takes at least a momentary pause. School stops on Tuesday, work stops on Wednesday, the stock market closes on Thursday. For nearly a whole week, we replace our march of averages, indices, and trends with a procession of things easier to understand: dinner, dessert, drinks. And the grocery store turns those items into a literal procession. Food items rattle by on the grocery store conveyor, giving a snapshot of coming meals. And hold on, snapshot. Maybe it's prediction withdrawal. Maybe it's pundit envy. Maybe it's just habit. But in this culture of trying to figure out every vote or market swing beforehand, I have found in that humming grocery parade of boxes, bags, and freshly misted produce a reliable indicator not just of future meals, but of family status. Call it the Family Checkout Food Index or something equally portentous, but I believe that grocery purchases tell a great deal about our world. Thanksgiving week is simple. A fresh turkey? We're not traveling. Jell-O and canned fruit imply children needing pacification. The big thing of peanut butter means nobody's buying school lunches for a few days. But the index predicts more than the specific and immediate. In general, the grocery conveyor correlates with family status remarkably well. If what goes by is ingredients, flour, vegetables, spices, we're doing well. We have time to cook. We're prospering. The rotisserie chicken may be cheaper, but actually roasting a bird creates an experience. It's placemaking, as the urban planners say. Ingredients are like investing in what my wife calls food infrastructure, enabling the cupboards to adequately handle future meal crises. A line of boxes, on the other hand, frozen things, instant things, rice, mac, or other Aroni products, are more like the payday lending of food. They'll get us through the week, but we're not building anything and we probably should be protected from ourselves. You can read too much into these predictions, of course, but some indicators are so accurate they border on scientific certainty. For example, my wife and I just bought several bottles of wine. This suggests that whether we're hosts, guests, or just hanging around this weekend, we can expect at least a short-term dip in major stress indicators. So may you all.
Scott Hewler is a writer living in Raleigh, North Carolina. His latest book is On the Grid. I had one big thing to give thanks for this week when I pulled into my neighborhood gas station here in L.A. Gas prices under $4 a gallon. Even $3.98 sounds pretty good to me after paying closer to $5 a gallon a few months ago. Well, it's enough to make a driver think about moving to cheaper territory where gas prices always come in below the national average. So may I suggest Oklahoma? Oklahoma has not only some of the cheapest gas in the country, but a lot of gas stations. Reporter Catherine Roberts set out to find out whether the two are connected.
On the south side of the University of Tulsa, across the street from the on-campus apartment where I lived as an undergraduate, sits a Quick Trip gas station and convenience store, frequented by college students. Now, go a mile north, a little past the northwest corner of campus, in case you filled up but forgot you were thirsty. Pick up a 32-ounce fountain drink at another Quick Trip. Shoot, did you forget the taquitos? Just go half a mile east. Yet another Quick Trip has hot roller grills aplenty. The thing to understand about Quick Trip, other than that it's the biggest chain in Tulsa, which in turn has one of the highest concentrations of gas stations in the country, is that Quick Trip tends not to have customers so much as fans.
You know, if I'm in an area where there are Quick Trips, I won't buy gas anywhere else.
One of the things I like about it is that it is a local company. If I'm going to be really honest, it's that they have a great selection.
That's Bob Roberts and Raquel Phillips, typical fans. So how did Tulsa end up with so many gas stations?
With relatively low cost of land in this part of the country, it's easy for people to have quite a bit of land and live far from the population center.
That's Chad Settle, professor of economics at the University of Tulsa. He says we're spread out, so we drive more, which means we demand more gas. It's different from a place like Los Angeles, where people drive a lot, but land is expensive. In Oklahoma, companies can afford to build more stations. Now, a lot of stations constitutes an abundance of supply, so could this be a reason behind gas prices that are regularly well below the national average? Chuck May with AAA Oklahoma thinks so.
This competition really helps keep our prices lower here in Oklahoma. And because of that competition, you know, we really come out the winners, the motorist does, because the prices typically then are lower than the rest of the country.
Now, May doesn't think that this is the only reason Oklahoma prices are so low or even a major reason, but Tulsa's high number of stations does have some influence. To confirm that theory, I turn to who else? Quick Trip.
My name is Mike Thornbrew, and I'm a spokesperson for the Quick Trip Corporation.
He says stores do compete against the guy across the street, but while QT is committed to having the lowest fuel price in town,
we found over the years if you spend all your time concentrating on what everybody else is doing, you lose sight.
For a third opinion, I asked the University of Tulsa economist Chad Settle.
It's theoretically possible that that could occur if you were in a market where a lack of competition was leading to higher prices.
But he says in Tulsa, that's not what's happening.
We don't have significantly larger number of competitors. We just have a larger number of gas stations for those competitors.
He says what really lowers prices in Oklahoma are things like the low state gas tax and proximity to refineries.
Obviously, your transportation costs are going to be smaller the closer you are to refineries, which enables them to potentially sell to lower prices to consumers.
Still, even if all those stations sitting on cheap land doesn't get me a lower price at the pump, they are good for me as a consumer. Because let's face it, I really like never having to travel more than 3 minutes to get a 32-ounce iced tea at Quick Trip. Just ask Bob and Raquel.
Do you think there are too many for the Tulsa market?
There are occasionally times I'm going someplace and I don't pass one, so no, there aren't enough yet.
Oh, no. If anything, I wish there were more.
In Tulsa, I'm Catherine Roberts for Marketplace.
And it's not just higher fuel prices at the pump that'll put a dent in your wallet on the busiest travel weekend of the year. Fuel prices influence the price you pay for air travel as well. But airline ticket prices may be going up in the future for another reason, a shortage of pilots. Seems the FAA is making it tougher to qualify for the co-pilot's job. But there's a whole bunch of reasons the industry could run into turbulence on the pilot front. Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly is here to fill us in. Seth, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Walk us through this. Why might we face a big pilot shortage?
First of all, you have a lot of pilots who began flying back after the Vietnam War, all turning 65 years old. And that's a particularly magic age for pilots because in the United States, that's when you have to retire. Even if you still have your wits about you, you can't fly commercially anymore. Then you also have new requirements that make it much more difficult to become a pilot. You need to fly a lot more practice hours before you can fly for an airline. Then on top of all that, well, you have lots of other airlines around the world that in the past weren't all that relevant, now growing very rapidly, in some cases in their own desperate need of pilots and willing to pay quite a lot of money for them. So they're trying to get these pilots who would have in the past almost automatically flown for U.S. carriers to go overseas.
So if this pilot shortage occurs, which we think it will, what does that mean for you and me who are, frequent flyers or infrequent flyers?
It's a labor market, just like any other. If any other business suddenly finds itself short of workers and it really needs workers, it's probably going to have to pay a little bit more than it's offering right now. And that's what's likely to happen with pilots. So pilots might become a little more expensive. You know, at some point, the money will be good enough and the compensation overall will be good enough that more people will want to become pilots, but that'll drive airlines' costs up. Now, for perspective, pilot costs aren't the most important line item on an airline's financials, but they are an important one.
So which flyers do you think would be most affected by the pilot shortage? Those of us who fly on these little regional airlines?
You know, the airlines sort of back into the math with all of this. Okay, they know how much it costs to fly. And then based on that, they know what kind of fares they need to break even and hopefully make a profit. And then based on that, they decide how much supply to put into the market, which in the case of airlines means how many seats to offer. So right. If they don't offer as many seats, basically what you have is people bidding on those seats, and it's only the people who are willing to pay the most who get to fly. So it tends to be the very price-sensitive travelers who are most impacted.
Now, you mentioned that pilots are going to be required to do more training hours, right? So theoretically, that means that we, the consumers and flyers, are going to be safer. So if we're paying a little more in ticket prices, it's worth the trade-off, right?
Well, I think we have to be a little bit careful about trying to decipher what's really going on with what some people are saying. You know, you have airlines on one hand saying, oh, this is terrible. This is going to cost a lot of money. But they have an agenda. You know, they want to be careful about having to spend too much more on pilots.
Right.
Pilots and their unions, on the other hand, are saying, well, this is all in the name of safety. Now, of course, they're concerned about safety. We're all concerned about safety. But, you know, they have an agenda, too. And anything that sort of tips the labor market in their favor is helpful to them. Important to remember that despite some concerns, not as if we had a safety crisis. It's the safest it's ever been, even before these new regulations.
Right. So bottom line, Seth, is in the future, we could have trouble finding as many pilots as we need. That could mean that their salaries are going to go up a bit, and that could mean that we're going to pay a little more for our airline tickets.
Exactly. Nobody should be alarmed by any of this. It's not as if the cost of flying is going to double. It's another cost. When jet fuel goes up in price, it becomes more expensive to fly. When pilots go up in price for airlines, it also becomes more expensive to fly. Not by as much more, but certainly this will impact consumers in the same way as any other thing that airlines have to go out and buy to make it possible to fly would impact consumers.
Seth Kaplan is managing partner of the trade publication Airline Weekly. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Okay, so if pilots are going to get pricier, more airline fees can't be far behind, right? Well, we just hope it never gets this bad. Here's APM's Rico Galliano.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is your captain speaking. We've reached our cruising altitude. Just want to give you a quick rundown of the amenities available for purchase on this flight. In a few minutes, we'll be cutting off the supply of oxygen in the economy cabin. Additional oxygen can be purchased for a nickel per minute. Exact change is required. If you need change, our attendants will provide it to you for an additional fee of $1 per nickel. In about an hour, we'll be flying over the Grand Canyon, and you can take a look by inserting a $5 bill in the slot beside your window. The window shade will pop up for exactly 23 seconds. $30 to use the restroom, and when you get back to your seat, our attendants will be happy to recline it for you for $57. Or for $5, they'll punch you in the head so hard you black out for the whole flight. Now just sit back, relax, and enjoy the next 2 hours. At that point, passengers who refuse to pay our $200 completion fee will be thrown off the plane 36,000 feet above Wichita, while the rest of us continue on to New York. Thanks again for traveling with us. We know you have a lot of choices when flying, and they're all bad. So, shut up.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Send us your letters via our website, marketplace.org, or reach us on our Facebook page. Next time on the show, office space for working parents.
Oh, are you closing my laptop for me? Yeah, I don't think I'm going to get anything done with this child around.
Mommy.
We have semi-private work nooks. We have a work bar. Basically, it's co-working with hourly childcare.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.